Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Culloden.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Culloden, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Now, coming up on today's show, is the German economic miracle well and truly over? As we hear how the government wants to give every child 10 euros a month to deal with the pension crisis, we look at the economics of food and farmers' markets. Plus, with the continuing rising population, we look at the economic realities and deficiencies in our infrastructure. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Culloden on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, X and Blue Sky. Now, I'm going to start off this week by explaining to you who the bulls and the bears are. Now, this is not to be confused with the birds and the bees. So in the stock market, you will often hear if somebody is bullish or bearish. Bullish refers to somebody who is optimistic and feels that prices will rise, while bearish means that somebody feels the price might fall. But here's the way to remember the difference. A bear fights with his claws and pulls them down, while a bull fights by throwing their opponent up in the air. So the next time you hear of a bullish or bearish sentiment, or you get into a fight with either one of them, you will know how to handle it. Now, it seems that the German economy continues to be under serious stress. And this week we hear of a new scheme by the government to gift each child between 6 and 18 years of age 10 euros a month for their future retirement in a bid to future-proof the German pension pot. Is this a good idea? Or is it just another sign of a struggling economy out of ideas? Where once the German economic miracle was praised, we seem to be increasingly hearing about problems besetting the country. And writing about this has been Olaf Storbeck, who is the Frankfurt Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. And I'm delighted to say he joins me now on the line. Hello, Olaf.
Hi there.
Well, let's first of all start off with a problem rather than getting straight into the solution. Germany is spending a quarter of the German federal budget of around about 117.9 billion euros. And that's just to plug holes in the pension system. At the same time that the labour force is going into decline by 9%, that's what it's expected to be, lower in the next 10 years. So can you give us the inside track on what's really happening?
Well, I think you summarised quite a few of the KPIs or the kind of poor performance or the issues quite nicely already. I mean, the fundamental problem is Germany has a pay-as-you-go pension system where the current generation of workers pays the pensions of the current generation of pensioners, and we have a shrinking labor force, and baby boomer generations will retire over the next decade, while the younger generations who are entering the labor market are much smaller, which puts quite a lot of pressure on social security and in particular pension expenses. Which means contributions will rise while payouts will go down, which creates a pension gap. Which most economists think the best way to close it is private capital market backed pension systems on top of the existing pay-as-you-go pension plans.
But Olaf, if we were to look at this another very simple way, and I wouldn't need to be an actuary to put this forward. If simply the pension age that one would be in receipt of their benefits was to rise, maybe by 1 or 2 or 3 years, that would certainly make a big difference to that gap. But do you see current politicians grasping that nettle?
Well, you're absolutely right. This is one way of addressing the issue, which has been done. That's actually one of the few reforms over the past 20 years which was put into place in Germany under Merkel, under the Merkel government in, I think, 2007, they agreed kind of an extension of the pension age by 2 years, which was phased in gradually over the next, the phase in is about to complete in the next few years. But the problem is that this move to go from 65 as the public, the legal retirement age to 67 was hugely unpopular in Germany. In particular, within the Social Democratic Party, which backed the move in the Grand Coalition at the time, and the then Social Democratic Party leader got into really hot water with his own constituencies, so it's politically quite toxic and hugely unpopular. And if you want to be on the front page of the national tabloid with a really nasty headline, you suggest people work until 70 or something. So this is really political suicide if you make this call as a politician.
We've seen the same in France, and personally, I wouldn't like to be the politician who would be announcing this in any part of the developed world. But whether somebody feels it's politically toxic or otherwise, that doesn't change the numbers. But I do want to ask you, though, given that we've seen the rise of AfD, or Alternative for Germany, that particular party in Germany, which obviously is extremely right wing, what has been the impact of the demand for these types of approaches that AfD brings to the political sphere? What has been the impact of that really on policy on the ground?
Well, I think the AfD impact was pretty big when it comes to migration, and kind of the current government is pursuing a hardline stand on mainly illegal immigration, but immigration from outside of the EU in general as well. The AfD isn't for now really kind of dominating the debate in social security terms. So it's not like they are seen, people are not waiting or voting for them because they are seen as the party which might kind of keep your pension safe or something. They are, the program is not really as strong in terms of pensions, and it's not something people attribute to the AfD for now.
Okay, so there's less of a relationship between the AfD and any policy that they might have when it comes to pension or fiscal sustainability.
That's right.
Okay, but is there a wider issue then that we need to explore here before we get into the solution? And that is, Germany is in recessionary territory. It's had a recent 0.3% contraction in the last quarter. GDP has contracted in 6 of the past 10 quarters. And if we use GDP or gross domestic product as a measure, the economy is hovering at the 2019 level. Or in other words, the economy hasn't grown in the past 6 years net. Obviously, we had a pandemic in there. We had massive inflation in there. We've also had a range of other things that have happened along the way. But over time, what has been the cause of this stagnation in the economy, do you feel?
Well, that's obviously the $1 million question. And I think the short answer to this would be is that Germany was basically hit by three different heavy forces at the same time. One is kind of the most obvious hit was energy prices in the wake of the Ukraine war, as Germany was highly dependent on cheap Russian gas, which, first of all, initially prices kind of spiraled, and then the supply also got stifled or cut off after the pipeline was attacked. And so that's one of the key drivers. The second one is the crisis of the oil and the transition of the automotive industry and Germany's kind of exposure to the old technology, as in the internal combustion engine. And the third whammy was, it's kind of the reversal to some extent of globalization and the rise of China and the change of demand in China, because German engineering and manufacturing companies exported a lot of capital goods to China up to the pandemic over the past 20 years. And China now has turned into kind of a rival in engineering goods rather than a customer of German engineering goods. And those are kind of at least three key drivers which are all dragging down the German economy. And on top of this, to some extent comes, and this is going to change to some extent, relatively conservative fiscal policy and kind of an adherence to the relatively strict debt brake, which has now been loosened under the new government, but which was in place previously.
Okay, and if we could explore that element of the change in the debt brake and the fiscal conservatism, because all of the three forces that you've talked about there are probably likely to continue. The first one is different, of course, because we have seen a decline now in energy prices, but obviously the continuation of the Ukrainian war and the sources of energy changes that one a little bit, but the other two are still in place. So if I was to just ask you particularly about that, like there was huge excitement earlier on in the year across Germany, yes, the stock market, the euro, the ECB, Europe in general, about the change that Germany was making, particularly to spend a lot more on infrastructure and defence. And there's a trillion euro debt spree that is going to happen over the next year. I just want to ask you, if we take away the narrative and we look at really what will happen, do you think this is a fundamental turning point for the economy? Or is it great fanfare? Because will the money really get into the economy due to procurement rules and bureaucracy and even the productive capacity of the country being able to absorb this money in real goods and services being sold to the government?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, this 1 trillion debt spree is not over the next year, but over the next decade or so. So, I mean, it's slightly more gradual than you described it. But it is still quite a big turning point to some extent, mainly because due to the focus on defense, as Germany will really or is changing tack on defense investment. That will take time. It will have the impact on growth will be lower than other investments because quite a lot of imported, a lot from the US. So the impact on domestic production is lower. And also there are arguments saying, well, eventually it's unproductive stuff, right? If you buy guns and ammunition, that won't have further positive knock-on effect on your productive capacity, unlike building a bridge or a new high-speed train link or something. But it will have some impact on demand and on production. And then there's this kind of, in combination with the defense spending, there's this push to ramp up domestic investment in road, in railway, and in other construction and other investment areas, which is definitely necessary. I'm not sure if you've taken a train in Germany recently, but the train network is in really dire straits. It's kind of in the English world, it's still, there's this cliche that German trains all run on time, which sadly isn't true anymore. We did some colleague of mine and I at the FT did a piece ahead of the election showing that even the least reliable train line in the UK, which I think was Eastern Anglia, or East Anglia, is more reliable than Deutsche Bahn these days. So there's quite a lot of need to invest more, and this is going to happen. It won't change kind of the German growth outlook from 0 to 1 in a year, and I think some of the hopes are overdone, but it will have some positive impact, and there at some point there should. I think it's likely that we will see a cyclical recovery, some hopes that this will turn into kind of the next economic miracle are overdone.
Well, to pick up on 2 points there, one is that it's actually some years since I was on a train. I have been on several of them across Germany, all right. So to answer your first question, and the second thing is you are correct that trillion euro is expected to be unleashed into the economy over time. What I was confusing that with is the expectation that in the next year that it would be felt in the real economy correcting me on that. But I do want to move to the solution that is seen or is being put forward now for the pension crisis. And that is that parents can now claim 10 euros per month to invest in a monthly share savings plan. And then they would be able to invest this on behalf of their child being anywhere from 6 to 18. It's set to cost 1.5 billion euros each year. And it's not just about the money. It's also with a view to getting people more so into the habit of investing, particularly the younger the better, so that then that can change through a generation that sense of ability to invest in the market. What do you think of that, first of all? And secondly, do you think it'll be effective?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's the key idea or the key aim of this plan is not really to fix the pension gap, because for that, the money involved is just too small, and it won't really move the needle in financial terms. The hope and the it's an academic idea which has been picked up by politicians and relatively swiftly and relatively unvarnished, which is quite remarkable in itself. The idea is that people basically oversee the investment of their kids, and then over time realized, diversified long-term low-fee investment in the stock market is not like going to the casino, but it's kind of over time relatively boring but also relatively high yielding exercise, by experiencing this behavior might change over time. And I think from that regard it's quite a good idea, because it gives people kind of an easy entry into kind of broad-based diversified stock market experiences and investment experiences, and I think it can have some impact. The whole thing falls short a bit, because the more straightforward way of doing this would be to reform a private pension plan that was introduced also about 20 years ago, which was kind of ill-designed and just didn't really take off because of too many regulations and too many kind of caveats which were built in. But I think it's a good step in the right direction, and will hopefully have some impact on people's perceptions of on the stock market.
But I think that's the key point that you're making, which is it's about the perceptions. I mean, I was struck by in your piece that you wrote about this, that 17% of the adult population in Germany owns shares, investment funds or ETFs, in comparison to 39% in the UK. And 62% in the US. Like, there is something to be said for a country's attitude to risk or to financial literacy or to putting money into its productive capacity, or even what assets can be taken on board to counteract against debt and so on. So could you characterize the current German investor for us, please, Olaf?
Oh, that's a tough one, because I think that one typical investor doesn't really exist. The main problem is, I think you need to look at three different segments, and two are relatively early dealt with, quickly dealt with, and are not the problem, so the one are the wealthy rich people. They are those predominantly investing in the stock market at the moment, and they are not really those the politicians need to think about, because they have the funds and they also have the exposure. Then you have kind of maybe 20-30% of the population which is cash constrained, not wealthy, and plainly don't have the funds to invest, which need to be dealt with in a different way. And those won't be kind of benefiting from any attempts to ramp up private pension provisions, because they just lack the cash to do this. But then you have this big group in the middle who at the moment are using low yielding, and they have quite a lot of savings, but they're using low yielding bank products.
And I saw, in fact, Olaf, that is 37% of €9 trillion financial assets are being held in cash and low yielding bank deposits indeed. So, I mean, I can see the impact of this and the need, of course, to be able to shift the mindset towards a higher risk for both the short and the long term. And really like to thank you very much indeed for joining us today. I know that there's a lot going on at the moment. So thank you very much indeed for joining me. Olaf Storbeck, who is the Frankfurt Bureau Chief of the Financial Times. Thanks a million.
Thanks a lot.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at Ireland's rising population and ask if it's gotten too big for our economy. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. And now on to our economic trivia. And I first of all want to thank all of those who emailed in last week about economic birthdays. And this week, I'm going to ask you two questions again. Please do email us in takingstock@newstalk.com if you know the answer. And again, I will give you the answers at the end of the show. So I was at Robbie Williams in Croke Park last week and it was absolutely fabulous. I was belting out songs right throughout to help him out. And I was in Slane to see him as well in 1999, and that venue holds 80,000 people. So it got me thinking, right? Croke Park can hold slightly more. I'm not telling you how many yet. But my two questions this week are, which stadium in Europe has the biggest capacity? And secondly, where does Croke Park fit in the ranks of European stadia? Now, so this week, the CSO told us that it was the fourth successive 12-month period where more than 100,000 people immigrated to the state. So how could or should this development affect future economic planning? Now, I'm joined by planning experts Conor Skehan and Professor Mary Gilmartin in the Department of Geography at Maynooth University. So let me set the scene for you both, first of all. Ireland's annual population growth at 1.64% is about seven times higher than the EU average of 0.23%. We're likely to reach 5.5 million by the end of the year. And if we look at the composition of the Irish population, 84.5% are Irish citizens, 15.5% are non-Irish, and of them, half are from the UK, half are from the EU, 13% from the UK, and the remainder is from the US, Australia, and other parts of the world outside of the EU. And as of the end of June, 32,689 people were in international protection accommodation centres. So, Conor, I'm going to start off, first of all, what is your initial reaction to the news that came out this week about our population growth?
We are continuing to grow very strongly. I would be of that school that thinks that more people is always good. It's more brains, it's more brawn, it's more tax, it's more dreams, it's more aspirations, it's more energy. So more people is good.
Okay, and Professor Mary, what is your reaction to the fact that we do now have more than 100,000 people immigrating into the state for the fourth successive time? What does that mean from a geographical perspective?
Well, we have over 100,000 immigrating, but we also have 60,000 emigrating. So what we're seeing is the repetition of the same pattern of people coming to and leaving Ireland. You know, we've had population growth consistently for 35 years in this country, so it's not new. And the movements of people that we're seeing into and out of Ireland, quite a lot of them are Irish citizens who are returning from other parts of the world. There are people coming from Britain, from the EU as part of our membership of the EU, and there are people of Irish descent as well coming from other parts of the world. So it's actually a repetition of a pattern that we've seen for a long time. The numbers are larger now, but they were also before the crash in 2007. And we know from that period and also from the COVID period how quickly that can change.
So, Conor, Mary says there that this is a pattern that we've seen for several decades at this point. One might argue that it's accelerating now. And are we building the country to be able to deal with this quickening pace, do you think?
I don't think so. We tend to do planning and infrastructure very poorly here. We have a very poor culture of governance, a very poor culture of implementation and execution. And most of it tends to be reactive. And the reactive is always catch up. It's always less than satisfactory. And the game is kind of running out because the numbers are becoming sufficiently large now that you can't really duck and weave and make good anymore. It's really hitting a critical issue.
Mary, if I go back to something that Conor said there at the beginning, he said more people equals more brains. And the thing is, more people also equals more workers. Like, we now have 2.8 million people in employment for the first time ever. So far this year, the tax take is 20.3 billion euro. That was 3.9% higher than what was collected in the first 7 months of the year. So does the government now have the resources to be more proactive? Conor said there it tends to be reactive when it comes to infrastructure and so on. But are we now in a different position where we know this is happening? We're getting more money. There's more people working. Are we on the right track?
We've known this is happening for a long time, and Conor is absolutely right. We haven't been preparing for it and we haven't been planning for it. We do have an opportunity now to actually invest in the infrastructure that we need, everything from housing, schools, the provision of facilities like care facilities, childcare and so on. But we haven't been doing this systematically, and we do need to do it because immigration is being used to fill a lot of gaps in the labour market. For example, there were over 40,000 employment permits issued last year. These are people coming to work in healthcare, in ICT, in construction, in accommodation and food services. But they're not going to want to come if they can't find a decent place to live, if they are just working to survive in Ireland, if they're unable to have a decent kind of life in terms of access to healthcare, childcare, other things that people need to live in a meaningful way.
Now, Conor, when we take into consideration 40,000 employment permits were issued, did you say, Mary, in the last year?
In 2024.
In 2024. I'm going to add a couple of more statistics to this. And Conor, I'd just like
you
to get your
like
take.
Your statistics, Susan, don't you?
I do. I absolutely do, yes. So, one in five workers in the country are non-Irish. In 2023, more than 23% of all nurses directly employed were from outside of Ireland. Nearly four in every 10 doctors registered with the Irish Medical Council are from outside of Ireland. There's been an 84% rise in migrant workers in construction and 82,000 migrants working in food accommodation. Conor, where would our labour force be if we didn't have these types of numbers?
Susan, why are those figures any different to any other country in Europe in terms of the makeup of where different sectors of the workforce come from? So I think it's very important to just cut straight through those types of alarmist statistics and to...
Well, why are they alarmist? They're simply statistics, Conor.
Because they're trying to make statements that sound as if there's something unusual about mobile workforces. Mobile workforces are the sign of a healthy economy and a healthy society, and people follow the work and the opportunities.
But where I was coming from is the fact that if we didn't have these workers, then our labour force would be in a very different position. It wasn't to be alarmist or even make any statement. It's simply a statement of fact that...
Yeah, well, everybody would be the same. If we'd no food, we'd be hungry. But we do, and we have those, and we have systems, and we have an attractive society and an attractive country where we are blessed with people who want to share our country with us. It's fantastic. We are lucky. We are lucky that they want to come here. We're lucky that they feel like it's a welcoming place. We feel it's a place... People feel that they can live their lives and have the best years of their lives here. I think it's fantastic. We're very lucky.
And Mary, what do you feel the outlook is for the relationship between the economy and the labour force? I mean, unless we have people to work here, the economy can't necessarily grow.
Yes, the economy needs workers, but it's also really important that we don't fall into the trap of thinking about people who are here only as workers. We need to think about them as people with mm-hmm. the richness of their lives. And yep. a lot of the debate that I hear is about people filling gaps in labour markets. And I spoke about that a little bit earlier. But it has to be about more than that. It has to be about people being able to participate in society, to contribute to society, to be able to feel at home here. So if we don't have that, we're not going to have much of a society. And if we don't have much of a society, then our chances of having any kind of economic growth or development are pretty slim as well.
Okay, so if we pick up though on your point about the reality is people are going to come here, whether it is from a perspective of work or school or anything else, they still need a place to live. And we have to deal with this point as well. Because here's another statistic now for you. No surprise there, Conor. So the ESRI says that we need 44,000 homes annually. But if we were to move to a high international migration scenario, then and that would be a population growth of 1.2%, we'd need up to 53,000 houses. But the growth is actually faster than that. So, Conor, how do we house everybody?
Oh, in a leap, our heroine was free. I used to be the chair of the housing agency, and one of the things I commented upon at the time was a pattern of people systematically talking up the amount of houses and housing that are needed. It follows a very predictable set of waves. I'm not going to get into the detail of who does it or why they do it, but we eventually found ourselves in a situation in 2008, I think it was, or seven, where we managed to build 100,000 new units in a year. We all know what happened because we did that. So there are a whole series of forces at work that are amplifying up the amount of housing that's needed. There is absolutely no doubt that a country that is growing, that is young, that is vital, will continue to need more housing. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And there's absolutely no doubt that we are building more slowly than would be desirable for a whole series of structural reasons that go back to that thing I mentioned a moment ago about our utter uselessness at implementation, our utter uselessness.
And who's our? When you say our, who's our?
We have a public service. We have by far the most centralized public service in all of Europe. We are more centralized than all of the countries in Eastern Europe have ever been. We've no idea. We're like people in a room who don't understand what it's like to have the full budget of oxygen available to us. We are continuously living on the dribs and drabs of really, really bad administration because it's too centralized.
So when we look at the fact, let's say, that Irish Water says that it won't be able to connect up more than 35,000 new houses without additional funding, whereas the demand for housing is significantly more, whether you look at it in any sort of a scenario. Is this an example of what you're talking about? Is one arm of the government isn't talking to another?
It's more than that. The problem, and sorry for hogging the line, is that all of our major infrastructure providers are in a mode where they think that their job is to serve existing and imminent needs. They don't do long-term planning. So people like, I won't mention any particular utility, would break your heart when you say, look, we're going to need to have more industry in this particular part of the country by this year. And they say, well, look, that's not our job. Our job is to only provide for markets that are already there. And that's a very deep structural problem with the way Ireland is put together.
Okay, well, if we move away, let's say, from the broad macro look at the country, Mary, and I just want to delve into a couple of areas, because the population in Longford, since this is in between the two censuses, 2016 to 2020, population Longford grew by 14%, Meath by 13%, Fingal by 11%, Kildare by 11%. And these are higher than the growth rate of 8% over the 6 years in the intermediate time. What is needed from a regional focus to make sure that the living conditions is suitable for all people in the community, people coming to the community, people commuting from, etc.?
So this is an issue we've been grappling with for decades at this point, and it's around regional development and balanced regional development. And we're seeing that Dublin and the Dublin region is growing while other areas are not growing at the same pace or in the same way or are in fact aging. We had a really nice opportunity, strangely enough, with COVID because of the move to remote working for a lot of employers and a lot of people. And that made living in areas far away from Dublin more feasible for people in a way that it hadn't been before. But we're now seeing employers roll back on that in a number of situations, so that the possibility of living, for example, in Sligo, where I come from, or Mayo or Donegal, and working for an employer based in Dublin is no longer as feasible as perhaps it would have been during the COVID era. So we have to think about the scale of employment, the kinds of employment that's available. Sometimes actually there's better availability of housing in areas outside Dublin, but then access to other kinds of services are difficult. And we're really seeing a crunch at the moment with access to GP services, particularly in rural areas. And again, it's part of that failure to plan. It's part of the failure to think in a long-term way, and a failure to think about what the country could be like in 10 or 15 or 20 years and to work towards that rather than short-term political gains.
But I'm wondering, Mary, and I suppose I'm asking you a similar question that I've asked to Conor, is that can we just lay all of this at the feet of government? I mean, is there also a need on the part of employers or community leaders, or I'm just looking for the private sector, whoever else? Is it just up to the government to deal with this, or is there a wider responsibility on the part of other stakeholders in our economy and population?
Well, quite a lot of the infrastructural development is state funded and state led. So government has an important role. Local authorities have lost a lot of the power that they might have had as well. It's, you know, it's been taken away from them, and it would be good to see local authorities with a bit more ability to shape the places where they are. The public sector has a role to play, but absolutely employers do. Educators do, universities do, third level education institutions do. All of these play a really important role in developing vibrant communities and vibrant societies. But if we're being restricted from thinking long term about what we need, if that funding isn't available or that vision isn't available, then it's really difficult for individual groups or small communities to make very meaningful and larger scale changes.
I could continue this conversation for so much longer with you both, and hopefully on another occasion I will. But for now, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed to planning expert Conor Skehan and Mary Gilmartin, professor in the Department of Geography at Maynooth University. This is Susan Hayes Culleton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the economics and joys of farmers' markets. Now today, we're exploring the economics of food and farmers markets where culinary tradition meets global trade. So I'm joined by Darina Allen, chef, author and founder of the Ballymaloe Cookery School, and Jackie Spillane, director of Spillane World Markets. And together, we're going to look at how local markets are shaping communities and how they fit into wider economic forces. So first of all, Jackie, I'm going to start off with you. Can you tell me what characterises the business model of a farmer's market as distinct to traditional retail that might be bricks and mortar, etc.?
Well, it is going from market destination to market destination and with the intention of reaching critical mass in one day at that destination. So, for example, if a farmer is trading at the Kilkenny market on a Thursday, they will spend their day there. Then they'll travel maybe up to Dublin on the Saturday and reach an entirely different market there, and then maybe have a different market on the Sunday, and once again, reaching a different market. And then there's flexibility within that schedule for them to do their production, as opposed to the conveyor belt approach that you have to have when you have a retail outlet trading 7 days a week, or indeed supplying the multiples. So from a model point of view, it presents the farmers and primary producers with an opportunity to go direct to the customer, make the margin and have that interaction, as opposed to selling their product wholesale and being fleeced perhaps in that process. So it's definitely a lifestyle choice, and I can understand why somebody might choose to just wholesale and have a big truck come up once a week and collect everything. But to actually bring your shop to the market each week, it's a very vocational approach to a product, and it usually is hand in hand with extreme passion for what you're doing.
Well, certainly, Jackie, I've been out to some of your markets, and when you say it's a lifestyle choice, it's not an easy lifestyle at all. I mean, it's early doors, it's energy all day, and as you say, you have to pick up everything and leave every time you go into an environment. So it's not for the faint-hearted.
No, and there are several vendors, many vendors over the years who just simply can't hack it. They have a notional idea of what it's really like. But the truth is, for all the lovely sunny days, we have lots of dreary days and nasty weather that might clear up over the course of the day. But you might be setting up your stall in gusting and galing weather and just hoping that it turns. And those days are often the most rewarding because the vendors aren't busy maybe, and it gives them a chance to chat to their vendor neighbours. There's a lot of camaraderie, a lot of support that vendors get from being in a market, given that they're all small business owners the rest of the time and dealing with all their decisions and the impact of those decisions on their own. Coming to a market every whatever market day you're trading is it's a great opportunity to get some moral support and share information and feel like you're part of a much bigger picture, even though when you're on your own in the field, you might feel like you're part of a smaller picture.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Darina, I love the experience of going to farmers markets. It's something I love to bring international visitors to when they come over to Ireland as well. But from your perspective, what does Ireland do really well when it comes to this?
Well, just when you say that about going along to farmers and bringing people along, I often say to visitors to Ireland, or if I'm in another country, one of the first things I do is to head for the nearest market, really, because it gives you much more of an insight into the real life of the country and the people than any guidebook does. Because, you know, the stallholders are not there for decoration, they're there to make a living. And so it's actually real. And the people who come along there to buy in the market, so, well, markets are different in every country, but basically they're looking for real food, which is becoming more and more difficult to find nowadays because such a high percentage of the food in the supermarkets is ultra-processed food. I think in Ireland we have the distinction, or otherwise, of actually having eating the highest percentage on average of ultra-processed food in Europe.
Would you believe
4.9% of our weekly food spend, apparently average, goes on ultra-processed food? There's an unbelievable crisis.
Would you believe, yeah. Darina, I was actually about to quote that number to you, and I found that, as I'm sure you did, in the Journal of Public Health Nutrition, and I find that
That's
a striking
right.
percentage, yeah. that 54.9% of the Irish diet is indeed ultra-processed foods.
Yeah.
So, are farmers markets the antidote to that then, do you think?
Well, for some people, they certainly are. I mean, the farmers markets were born out of desperation, really. Desperation is a brilliant thing in many ways, but because something has to work if there's desperation. So the first farmers market in Ireland was in the Cold Quay in Cork. I was very much involved in the founding of it. And that was started in 1996. My mother-in-law, Myrtle Allen, and the whole Cork Free Choice consumer group. So we started up in the Cold Quay in Cork, and that was in 1996. And then the others have followed on from there. But basically, a lot at that time, the supermarkets, most of the consumers wouldn't have been aware of this in any way. But the supermarkets has just gone over to a central distribution system. In other words, and the smaller supermarket shops like the Centris and so on around the country that were owned by the big supermarket chains were actually told that they would be penalised if they actually bought more than 2% of local food. Now, a lot of small local farmers and food producers were dependent on those small shops to actually sell their produce. And suddenly they were told, no, no, we can't buy your produce anymore. So the farmers market just came, that movement we started just in the nick of time when people were faced. A lot of farmers, you see, they were too small to go into central distribution. In other words, what they wanted was everything, if you were growing potatoes or cabbages or whatever, to send them all to Dublin first to the central distribution depot, and then they would be redistributed back around the country. So suddenly local people found they couldn't get local food any longer, and the local food producers had no way to sell their produce to local people. So when the farmers markets movement started, then it meant that people could actually buy the food directly from the farmers. The farmers could at long last get the full price into their hand. They could have a rapport with their customers. A lot of them, you would know their customers on a first name basis. They had a bit of cash flow to pay their bills as they came in. So it's a vitally important movement. And there are many, many farmers now, smaller farmers particularly. It's not for everybody. It's a solution for some people and a growing number of people. A lot of them would tell you they wouldn't be still on the farm if it wasn't for the farmers market movement. So it wouldn't still be growing. And no farms, no food.
Well, Dorina,
we really need to hear that.
I'm from Cork myself. As listeners to Taking Stock are constantly reminded, so I remember when the Cold Quay market began, and of course many subsequent to that. And Jackie
and Mann and Middleton and all of those as well. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. As they say, if you want to know whether somebody is from Cork, they will always tell you. So, Jackie, can I just pick up on the point there that Dorina made around the impact of the local business? Right. So as she quite rightly says there, if there's no farm, there's no food. But if we look at those in the community that aren't necessarily directly involved, like Bord Bia published some research saying that for every 10 euro spent at a farmer's market, it generates 24 euro in the local economy. Where do you see this in action?
In terms of a well-established farmer's market, let's use that model, it's a microeconomy. There are vendors travelling. So, for example, I'll use the Red Stables Market in St. Anne's Park on a Saturday. We have around 50 plus vendors, depending on the time of year. They are travelling from various parts of the country, most of them from Dublin and from the Leinster region. But there are ones who come from further afield. And they come in every Saturday morning and they set up their stall. And in many cases, they have to hire local people to help them out on the stall. So, for example, if you're travelling from Cavan, it really doesn't pay for you to bring somebody from Cavan, then you were paying them 2 hours each way. So they hire local people. And so, for example, on a Saturday, we have over 120 people employed at the market. That's just specifically working at the market. That doesn't include the drivers, the people back on the farm, the people in the kitchen making food for the next day. So that's quite a microeconomy right there, because there's a huge percentage of those people from the Dublin region, and quite specifically from the Ruachuli Clontarf region. And so that's an enormous impact that's frequently not discussed, the employment that markets create, and the fact that the majority of money spent at a market remains in the country versus money you spend in Tesco or any of the multiples, regardless of whether they're Irish owned, a vast amount of their turnover leaves the country. So at a farmer's market, that does not happen. And it's also an environmental choice. People are now making the choice to shop at a market simply because there's the low carbon footprint. A lot of the product has come from a very short distance. There's minimal packaging. Vendors don't waste packaging. They're very cost conscious. And so it's up to the stall to to deal with their product, but it's dealt with in a minimal fashion. And there's an increasing amount of people bringing their own Tupperware dishes and things like that to get meat from the butchers into, instead of going into a plastic bag. So the knock-on effect of all of that, not to mention the fabric of the community that shop there and meet each other, that has a knock-on effect on the economy as well, just more people out and about. So it's very broad, but the employment, and actually a really important element is, once again, I'll use the Red Stables, we have over 40 different nationalities working there. Within that 120, 40 different countries are represented there. In some cases, they're stallholders. In some cases, they're employees. But regardless, it's an amazing example of assimilation and integration. And we have no conflict, far from it. We're all part of the same market community. And when you hear about issues in relation to immigration and all of that, I just think, gosh, we'd be lost without them. They've contributed so much to our modern Dublin.
Well, having been out of the Red Stables market, certainly, Jackie, I have eaten from all corners of the world. Sitting under a tree, that's my spot. That's where I'll be found. Doreena, can I come back to you about the point you made earlier around the role that markets play in terms of distribution or sales? Because Chagas published a report saying 80% of traders, now it's a while ago, but 80% of traders consider farmers markets their key sales channel.
Yeah.
But the larger artisan producer, and that was characterised with a turnover of over 200,000, naturally rely less on markets, and half of such producers get between 1% and 20% of their sales via there. Like your entrepreneurial empire, we'll say, how does, and I certainly would call it that, how does farmers markets fit in to that sense of being able to connect with customers, whether it is then afterwards because of brand awareness, people are buying online or they're coming back again the next week looking for that producer? How does it fit into that larger business model?
Well, funny, I have no business training, so I'm coming at this from a slightly different angle. I so believe in the importance of farmers markets, particularly for rural Ireland. Now, I have to say, yeah, I'm sure Jackie would agree with me that the Dublin farmers, in inverted commas, markets are quite different to the country farmers markets. Country farmers markets is all about local food. And when you were talking there a minute ago about the money going back into the economy, you pay a local stallholder in a market in, you know, anything from Macroom to Skibbereen to wherever, that money goes to the farmer. It goes to buy the food in the local shop. It goes to buy the school books. It goes to buy the thing. It goes back into the local area completely. And Jackie's point, of course, about the money going out of the country is very well made there as well. But the so, it's part of what we do. We have a stall in Middleton Farmers Market every single Saturday. And also there's another stall in Mahon Point Farmers Market. So basically, I feel so strongly about the importance of these markets. And you see, a lot of people, you know, who stand behind a stall, you might say, well, you know, they're going home with only 100, 200 or 300 euros for the day. But for many people, that makes the difference between survival or not. And the other people who are customers who are desperate to get real food, that fresh from somebody's garden or somebody's farm that they can trust, that's not laden with chemicals. And so on, and to be able to look somebody straight in the face and to know the source of your food. This is a super important thing. And, you know, sometimes I get so cross sometimes when people say, oh, I don't go to the farmers markets because they're so much more expensive there. Well, hello, they're usually the people who never go to the farmers markets for a start. But also, I think the general public doesn't realise that the reality for a lot of people, producers, is if you get a third, if the farmer is paid a third or the producer is paid a third of the price, retail price on the shelf, they're very lucky. And they're even luckier still if they get paid within a month or 2 months. So, you know, you can imagine this makes a very big difference. And also the other thing that really boosted sales, I've spoken to a couple of people, obviously in COVID, people poured into the farmers markets, which was wonderful. But then that, drew back a bit after COVID. But the other thing that really helped recently, if you like to look at it from this point of view, basically were the food scares. Suddenly, you know, when we had those big big food squares and affairs a couple of weeks ago there when a lot of food was withdrawn off the shelves in so many shops and supermarkets. People realised that so much of the food under different labels was being produced all in one place. No idea, different names, different whatever. So it was suddenly more and more people woke up and said, well, hang on a minute. At least if I go along to my farmer's market, I can speak to the person who's growing and producing this food. And that's not an insignificant thing.
Well, there is a clarion call then out to our listeners to make sure and get out to your local farmers markets this weekend, wherever you might be. Thank you so much indeed, Dorina Allen, chef.
And I'll tell you what, can I say one last little thing? It's really important to pay the farmer rather than the pharmacist.
Right.
For real food rather than spending it on meds.
Thank you.
Grandmotherly point at the end.
Thank you very much indeed, Dorina Allen, chef, author and founder of the Ballymaloe Cookery School, and Jackie Spillane, director of Spillane World Markets. Really appreciate you joining me today.
Thank you.
Now, before we go, I want to give you the answers to the two economics trivia questions from earlier. The stadium with the largest capacity in Europe is the Nou Camp in Barcelona, and Croke Park is the third largest in Europe with Wembley in the middle. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and I hope that you learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo de Silva Scott was on sound, and thank you so much for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day, and I look forward to chatting to you again next week.